Morning, everyone. Please take your Bibles out and turn to John chapter 11. John chapter 11. It's important you do that today because we're going to spend almost our entire time in this chapter. And I'd like you to see what John is recording here for us because I think there's a very important lesson we need to draw from that. I'll start off, though, by asking you a question, and that is, what have you cried about recently? What has brought tears to your eyes? As I've gotten older, and I think about the time I started having grandchildren and those kinds of things, I found myself with little tears coming down now and then. And I prided myself, you know, for many years, as I know some of you men did as well, that maybe that's not going to happen. And even yesterday, we're sitting in the memorial service, and almost like you can't help it. You know, the little tear kind of drips down, and you almost feel a little bit funny. Well, it's all right for women to do that, but the guy, you know, you kind of flip that away and get, okay, I'm a strong guy. But what did you cry about last? What is it? I've even kind of gotten teary at weddings, and I don't even know the people. You know, I mean, there's just things going on. Maybe it's in my own mind or what have you, but the bigger question that I'd like us to look at today is, what makes God cry? What makes God cry? I know for sure that He doesn't cry when a faithful servant goes home to the Lord, when a faithful servant dies. He doesn't cry then. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of His saints, Psalm 116, verse 5 says. But there is and are some things that make God cry. Best way to figure that out, find out what it is to look at a time when God cried. You're familiar with John 11:35, I know. Some of you young people, kind of when, you know, your teacher asks about, do you have a memory verse, a favorite memory verse, and you kind of snicker and you say, I got one. Jesus wept. And then you feel kind of, you know, proud of yourself. And if the teachers are smart, they'll always ask where it comes from. You know, where do we read that? That's John 11:35. And Jesus said it. Jesus wept. He didn't say it. He did it. But the sermon we're going to look at today comes from this very famous little verse. And I'll tell you that I don't think it means what you might think it means. I think it means something far more important. The big point I want to make today is that Christ has done everything possible to persuade us to believe. He's done everything in His incredible power to help us believe. That's where we're going with this. But I'm going to read chapter 11 down through verse 44. So read along with me. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped His feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to Him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, He said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when He heard that Lazarus was ill, He stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, He said to His disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to Him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, He said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to Him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that He meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." When she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let them go." Jesus has done everything possible to help us believe. And let me ask you a question. If you had a friend and you knew this friend was very, very sick, and you knew that there was a cure for this friend, this is your best friend, you had access to the cure. If you knew that, what would you do? You'd rush to that friend, wouldn't you? You'd go to them and say, "This, I found the cure for this. I had this myself and I've been cured, and I want you to have it." Of course you would do that. But let me raise the stakes, and you've got to use your imagination here, of course, but let's say that the friend dies. But somehow, through some dispensation, you got the ability to raise the dead, but you only get 3 tries. Would you go to that friend and use one of those on them to bring them back? If I had added the fact that that person was a faithful Christian, someone that you had no doubt in your mind that person was in heaven, in the presence of God, would you use it on that person? I probably would, if that was a good friend of mine. But I want you to think about that as we consider what is going on in this text. Consider what John's purpose is. Remember that John is writing so that we might believe. Jesus did many other signs. He did many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are done that you might believe, and believe that you might have life. That was John's purpose. If you miss that as you read through the Gospel of John, you're missing the whole point. This is the point of John. This is the reason he wrote the book. He chooses a few events, 7 events, to make that point. 7 signs. A sign is something that leads you to somewhere else. So when you see the sign, when you turn the water to wine, it wasn't just, there's the miracle that he did. There's the the wonder that he performed, there was something behind that. It's impossible to turn water to wine. It's impossible to feed 5,000 with a few loaves and fishes. But he did that. He created those and fed them. It's impossible to give a blind man, a man who's been blind from birth, it's impossible to give him sight. But he did all those things and more. So he did those things in order to make the point that Jesus is the Son of God. To reinforce Jesus' point that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him. What does believing do for us? I mean, I'm sure, you know, sometimes you might think this is a question. Maybe we shouldn't ask it this way. What does this do for me? It's all right. You can ask it that way. Because God tells us in his word what it does for us. Look at verse 25 of this text. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? So what does it do for you? It means you're not going to die if you believe in him. We need to take a little detour for just a minute back to chapter 5. I'm going to look at verse 18 through 29. Listen to what Jesus says, or what John says. Sometimes Jesus is talking, sometimes not. But starting in verse 18, this is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. When you just don't miss the, maybe it's nuanced here to you, but don't miss this. Every time Jesus called him his Father, in the sense that he did, he was making himself equal with God. He had this relationship with the Father that was defined as a Son of God. He made that point, of course, back in chapter 3 when he talked about his only begotten Son. Verse 19. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. It's like Father, like Son. You see this? So what Jesus is doing is what God gave him to do, or what he sees the Father doing. He's the pattern or the image or the imprint. He is the likeness of God. So when we see Jesus acting and speaking in the Bible, I know this is a reminder, but we're seeing God acting and speaking. And when we're trying to conform ourselves to Christ, we want to be like God in the sense in our behavior and our actions and our words, just follow Jesus. Verse 20, for the Father loves the Son. That's phileo, by the way. That's the Greek word that goes more toward the affection side. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and greater works than these he will show him, so that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life. Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has also granted the Son to have life in himself. And he has given him authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. So what's going on here? There is a circle of death and a circle of life. God does have a circle of life. We'll get to that in a minute. What happens is that we're born into the world, and at some point we spiritually die. We die because we're accountable to God, and we, as we often say, we know right from wrong and those kinds of things, whatever makes us accountable before God. At some point that sets in. And when that happens, if we don't correct that, if we don't come to Jesus for salvation, then we will die. We'll die eternally. There'll be no more life in us. That'll be it. And that's an eternal place that we'll find ourselves. And nobody wants to find themselves there. But that's where we will. Remember that when back in John chapter 3, in that famous verse in verse 16, "For God so loved the world that He gave His only Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish," that perish is in there. Perishing is a possibility. It's the only other possibility other than being saved. So if we don't do that, that's what we lead to. There's just no way around that. There's no middle ground. There's no purgatory. There's nothing to kind of, you know, nobody can baptize for us or kind of pray us out of this place. We go there and that's it. We perish. And that point is made here in chapter 5. When you look at the scriptures, verse 25. "It's an hour is coming and now is here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God." The dead are people who are spiritually dead. Obviously, he's not talking about people who are physically dead. He's talking about those who are spiritually dead. They'll hear the voice, and those who hear will live. But those who don't, he says, will go to judgment. Those who have done, verse 29, those who have done good to the resurrection of life and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. Everybody's coming out. So that's what's going to happen. Here's a better, this is the circle of life. That was the circle of death, half circle of death, I guess. But you're born, you hit that spiritual death point, and then you're born again. John talks about that back in John chapter 3. And of course, there's several passages on baptism. That new birth, your new creation, you're given life. God gives you that life. And then you have eternal life as long as you continue to believe. And so again, you see that what Jesus said, verse 25, the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. Then verse 26, "Don't marvel, an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear His voice. Come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life." So you want an A on this test. You want 25A. You want to be in the good that come to the resurrection of life. That's where you want to be, not on B, because B leads to a resurrection of judgment. Now, the point of all this is that Jesus has the key to life. It's Jesus. I know you know this. I don't know that you'd be here if you didn't know this. But John goes to some trouble to tell us that God has given this power to the Son. He has the power to make children, to produce offspring. Isaiah 53 talks about that. We are His offspring. That's what He did in His going to the cross. He has the key to us living eternally, but there's a condition, and that condition is that we believe. So I said all that to get back to this point. Why did Jesus weep? When we come to John 11, why did Jesus weep? Why does God cry? Why does that happen? When does that happen? And you got to remember that when we're looking here at John chapter 11, when we get back there, we're looking at about the last week of His life. It's coming into the last week of His life. And what we find here is that there's still a lot of weak faith, even among those who are closest to Him. Mary and Martha had what most of us would consider strong faith. I mean, after all, Martha says in verse 27, "Yes, Lord, I believe that You're the Son of God, that Christ is the Son of God who is coming into the world. I believe You are." That sounds an awful lot like what Peter said when he confessed Christ, and we give the credit to Peter so much, not so much to Martha, but we should, because that's the confession. But there's something lacking, just like in Peter after he made the confession. There's something lacking there. And what we see is this kind of weakish faith, if you will. Verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, "If You had been here, My brother would not have died." If you had been here, My brother would not have died. He says, Mary says the same thing. This really hero of faith that we see actually in chapter 12, that's referred to back up in verse 2, but we see her in chapter 12 where she anoints Jesus. She too says the same thing. "If You had just been here, My brother would not have died." It's almost, but not quite. Kind of this faith that's just about there. Now, is Jesus going to pack up and say, "Oh, that's good, I'm good with that. You know, that's close. As long as we're close." But that's not the way he approaches this. He has done everything. Remember that John 21 and verse 25 says the whole world couldn't fill up with books of the things he did. So we're just talking about seven signs in John. That's all we're seeing here. He's done all of these things to get these people to believe, and it just seems, and you've got to put yourself in the shoes of the disciples or sandals of the disciples and just say, well, yeah, I would have believed, you know, no question about that if I had seen these things. And if you do that, you're making a mistake. These were just men. These were just women. These were just people, just like us. And what I'm stressing here is that God Himself, Jesus Christ, is not pleased with this almost faith. He wants us to go all the way. He wants, as one song says, He wants us to have faith without borders. Faith without borders. Remember when Peter comes walking out on the water? And then he sinks. And we think, oh no, I would walk all the way to the boat. I'd get there. If we think that way, we're missing the point. Jesus sees these things. If you look at verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. The common view is that Jesus wept, down in verse 35, because he was sad, because he saw these other people weeping, and kind of you get caught up in that. You know, when you look at the pictures at a memorial service, that's what always kind of gets me. You look at those pictures from the past, and you think of better times. You think of those. Sometimes it doesn't have to be a memorial service, just when you look at old pictures. But you get older, and you look at those. And you just, you know, draw some tears, because you're thinking of those things. And I understand that. That happens all the time. When we see other people cry, I'm always amazed. I guess what I'm saying, I'm almost surprised, overwhelmed with this level of sorrow that I see at memorial services, especially when I get up and to do something. It shouldn't, but it always surprises me. But it's there, and it makes you commiserate. It causes you to empathize and sympathize with people. But is that why Jesus wept here, you think? There's some interesting things going on in verse 33. That I want us to see. Some interesting things in the original language that we might miss. In verse 33, you'll see this term, deeply moved. When he saw her weeping and the Jews had come with him weeping, he was deeply moved. If you've got an English Standard Version, look at the footnote. There's a footnote at the bottom. It's in mine, it's footnote number 3. Or was indignant. Now let me ask you a question. Is there any connection between those two things? If you think about someone who is being deeply moved and then cries, like we normally do, maybe at a memorial service or whatever, some sad situation, and being indignant? Now we have to make a choice here about whether it's indignant, because these two things don't correspond. You're either sad and you're weeping because everybody else is, and you're entering into a level of compassion with them, and that's why. Or you're indignant. Indignant means you're kind of angry. That there's some anger that's creeping in. And in fact, some groaning. In Matthew 14 and verse 5, when this same word is used, it talks about the disciples murmuring. They were indignant at what was going on. So how does that fit here? When he saw them weeping, Jesus was indignant. Greatly troubled. That's the word that's used when it talks about the troubling of the water back in John 5 when the man who had been lame for 38 years, he said, well, I can't get in because when the troubling or the stirring up of the water occurs, I can't get in fast enough. So what you have here in verse 33 is Jesus seeing the weeping, deeply moved, or groaning is another accurate translation of that. And if you look at this deeply enough, it even means to snort. As in, just to snort with indignation. Deeply moved or troubling, greatly troubled. And so if it's just that, well, he saw everybody, this is what I would expect. Verse 33, Jesus saw her weeping, and Jesus had come to weeping, and saw her weeping, Jesus wept. That's what I would expect. It's not what it says. It goes, Jesus saw him weeping, so the Jews who came with her weeping, he was deeply moved, indignant, groaning in spirit, greatly troubled. He said, where have you laid him? Come and see. Jesus wept. Now you're going to see this again in a minute. You're going to see it in verse 38 before he goes and raises Jesus from the tomb. But what we're seeing here is some kind of level of frustration and not just the compassion. There's no denying the compassion of Jesus. I'm assuming we all understand that. There's plenty of that to go around, all the miracles he did and everything else. But is that what he's talking about here? Let's look again at this as we look at the sequence here. Where have you laid him? Come see. Jesus wept. Now the Jews' view of this, which a lot of people take kind of at face value, verse 36, the Jews said, see how he loved him. Phileo again, the affection. See how affectionate he was toward him. And that's why he cried. But, verse 37, this is key, but some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? We've seen this three times now. We've seen it from Mary, Martha, and the Jews. They all said, well, if he was here, he could have kept him from dying. And there's some level of faith there. There's quite a bit of faith. Probably, we might be saying, well, I don't know, if we're honest with ourselves, that's pretty heavy-duty faith. I think we could go with that. Well, Jesus isn't happy with that. It's not where he wants us. Remember way back in chapter 2, when he had cleansed the temple? Listen to this. And I was so impressed, I have to give a shout out here to Stephen Ladd, because when he wrote a song that's in our book, he put this concept in here. And I think most of us miss it. But listen to John chapter 2, verse 23. And when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people. We could say that this way, in verse 24. Jesus, on his part, did not believe in them. Because it's the same idea. And needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew it was in man. They believed because they saw the signs. Later on in chapter 6, they come to him. They're following him. He says, you're not following me because you believe. You follow me because I fed you. And he says, to work for the bread that doesn't perish. So, does it make sense that he just is sad? Look in chapter 11 again. Look up at verses 4 and 6. 4:2-6. When Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Let me take a little side point. I thought that was kind of interesting, because when it says in verse 3 that, Lord, he whom you love is ill, that's phileo. And then when you come down to verse 5, that's agape, for those of you who care about that kind of thing. But I just thought that was kind of interesting. But he said, going on, verse 6, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer. Who does that? I start off with a thing. You knew you had the cure and your friend is sick. What are you going to do? You're going to get there as fast as you can. That's logical. That's what you do. But Jesus already said, verse 4, this doesn't lead to death. And now he says, I'm going to stay there 2 days longer. Verse 11, after saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. Disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he recovered. He said, he's dead. He's dead. They thought he meant to rest in sleep. Lazarus is dead. I'm going to awaken him. He's already said that. He knows he's going to see Lazarus again. He knows he's going to awaken him. That's what he's going to do. Why did he weep? Jesus wept because these people's faith was really weak. We might not think so looking at it. So they looked pretty good faith. It was weak. And he would do anything to improve his power, anything, to make them believe that he was the one who could save them. So Jesus is righteously indignant at the fact that there are people here who have seen him do all these things. He's coming to the end of his signs, which represent many more signs, and saying, they don't believe it yet. They just don't get it. And what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to raise Lazarus from the dead. Why wouldn't he want to do that? Why wouldn't he want to raise Lazarus from the dead? Where is Lazarus? Wherever there is. He knows where Lazarus is. He's in paradise. Let's put it that way. I think that's a safe thing to say for everyone. He's in paradise. He's in the presence of God. He's kicking back out of the reach of sin, out of the reach of the devil. That's where he is. This is a terrible analogy, but I'm going to use it anyway. Let's say I'm over in Hawaii. When I go to Hawaii, Christy and I have an opportunity to go over there, we do what some of the rest of you do when you go there, or your favorite place. You do nothing. You do a bunch of nothing, right? You do as little as possible. You take that time to relax, kick back. You like to. You don't even take your phone out. You know, you're laying out on outside or wherever. You just leave it off. You just kind of go in your own place, and you just want to be left alone. So you go there, you relax, you enjoy the perfect weather, you eat $20 salads. Well, that's not so much. That's almost part of the paradise, but you get the idea. It came to my attention that somebody thought I had passed away recently. Somebody got a message. We got a message on our phone. Got a message that said, "Is Dave okay? I heard he passed away." And as Mark Twain said, the rumors of my demise have been greatly exaggerated. I think. Unless I'm a hologram or something. I don't know what you call those. But anyway, so what if I'm even in Hawaii and Angie says, well, these people are saying you're dead. You need to come and show that you're not. They're not accepting pictures. They think they're doctored. They know you do Photoshop. They say, you got to come here in the flesh. They want to see you. I mean, I'd be impressed. I'd be flattered that people care that much. They say, so you got to come back from Hawaii. That's a terrible analogy compared to heaven, though, isn't it? I get on a plane, I go, I'm not going to like that. I don't want to come from Hawaii back. Where's Lazarus coming from? He's got to take him out of heaven. That's why he was upset. So he's going to do this one final sign. Verse 38. Then Jesus was deeply moved again. He was groaning because now it's going to happen. Deeply moved, indignant, if you use the footnote. He came to the tomb of the cave and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of dead man, said the dead man, this is kind of interesting too, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he's been dead 4 days. He said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. That reminded me yesterday when some of you were here and talking about Bill, you know, and his yelling and all that. So he'd be standing there with Jesus maybe too to help out, but. He cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died. Now, why did he say that? I don't know. Why didn't he say Lazarus? Why didn't he just say he? Maybe when you get into heaven, you shed all that physical stuff like names. God knows who you are. It's all that matters. But he said the man who had died came out, and his hands and feet bound with linen straps. Why didn't Jesus take the stuff off of him? Can you imagine? The spirit, so Lazarus is dead. His body is dead, laying in the tomb. The spirit comes back into the body, and now he's enlivened, and he walks out, and he's all wrapped up like a mummy. And then he tells him, you unbind him and let him go. I know there's sermons like, God doesn't do what we can do for ourselves. Maybe that fits there, I don't know. But he doesn't do that part. But Lazarus probably, what is going on? I'm not even, not only am I not, I mean, it's not like he came from there into Hawaii. A little better. He comes in, he comes out of the tomb, wrapped up, back to the place he was, and we'll see in a minute, he's in trouble. Do you think Lazarus wanted to come back? More importantly, do you think Jesus wanted to bring him back? I don't think so. Look what happens. And Jesus knew this was going to happen. Back in over in chapter 12. So when the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Can you imagine the pain that Jesus felt in having to bring his friend that he both phileo, had affection for, and agape, his friend bring him out of heaven to face this, to face the Jewish mafia who is chasing him down and hunting him down every minute of the day? Imagine the pain that Jesus felt to do that in doing that. But as I said at the beginning, he was going to go all out. He's going to pull out all the stops to make sure that people believe, even though their beliefs seemed to be pretty good. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't where it needed to be. Jesus wept because he saw what was going to happen to Lazarus. He wept because he was indignant that they had not come to a place of true faith as yet. He wept because he knew what sin was going to do to him and what sin was doing to the whole world. And so he pulls Lazarus out of the grave to try to make the point one final time before the resurrection, before his own resurrection. And even people didn't believe that. People today don't believe, even though Jesus was raised. So let me make one application. This has been all about Jesus, but who would you bring back if you could? Who would you bring back? I'm looking at some of you, and I know who some of you have lost. I know the people you've lost. I certainly know. I would love for my grandchildren to know my mother. I would just love for them to know that. They never did. They barely knew my dad. I would love for them to have time with him. My dad would make a meal at breakfast. He'd make it at 5 o'clock, get all the kids up, and it would be one thing. And if they wanted it, they'd eat it at 5 o'clock, and that'd be it. My mom would take orders. As the kids got up, she would do, so there's seven grandkids, she would do seven orders. And that's the way she was. And she would ask them what they want, and then she'd go do separate. That, I just love for my grandkids to know them. There's people that you can think of. Who would you bring back if you could? There are a few people I would bring back because I'm not sure where they are. If I had the power, because I'm not sure that they're where they need to be. And I think I have a good reason for believing that. I'm not judging anybody, but I'm just saying I would risk it because I don't think they're where they should be. But every single person, and believe me, there are a lot of them, a lot of people who've died way too young. Would we bring them back? Knowing where they are, knowing that they're in the presence of God. If I did that and had the power to do that, why would I do it? It'd be just evidence of my selfishness. That's what it would be. That's all it would be. I'd love to have them here. But if I did it, it would just be for me. It wouldn't be for them. Jesus wept because he had to pull Lazarus out of his home and bring him back to this crazy world that we live in. God weeps most of all. I think he weeps for when Bill Cain was in his wheelchair and had a stroke. I believe God, in some figurative sense, weeps for him, weeps for people in that kind of situation, weeps for the family who has to deal with someone who is lost. I believe God weeps a lot. But I believe he weeps mostly for the lost. He weeps because he sees the sin in the world. He sees what is happening to people, and he sees their eternal destiny because they simply refuse to address their sins And Jesus has done everything he possibly can up to and including, most importantly, allowing himself to be nailed to the cross and then raised again, of which there's all kinds of evidence for that. There's no doubt about that happened. And yet people still either will not believe at all or will kind of stay at arm's length, say, yeah, I believe this much, but I don't believe too much, because if I believe too much, then that might require me to go somewhere that I don't want to go, do something I don't want to do. What I learned from John 11 is that Jesus wants us to go as far with our faith as we can possibly go, and he can take us there. We can have faith without borders. And the failure to even want to do that causes Jesus to weep. God weeps for the lost. I'll leave this with you. Is he weeping for you today as someone who hasn't come to this place where you believe? We're going to sing number 420. Think about that. There are things that Jesus has asked us to do. He's asked us to unite with him in his death and his resurrection, Romans chapter 6 says to do. He's given us that model. Paul gave us that model. Here's what Jesus did. He died, he was buried, and he raised again. And he's given us the option to do that. He's given us the power or the right to become children of God, which is a great power that he's given us, John 1:12. And if you're not a child of God yet, remember that where that circle leads. It leads one of two places, and we hope that you'll make the decision that will cause you to lead to eternal life as we stand and sing.